Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie, the official podcast of FThisMovie.net, movie love for movie lovers. My name is Patrick Bromley, and I'm super excited for this week's show slash experiment. We're doing a two-part crossover event. This is some CW shit. Talking werewolf movies. So for this week's F This Movie, I'm talking Silver Bullet with the co-host of Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers and the author of Scored to Death. Welcome back to the show, Mr. Blake Fischera. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for coming back to the show. You were on September, roughly, talking about your book, right?
Yeah, sometime in the late summer or early fall, probably.
That's awesome. And so we're going to be talking Silver Bullet on this show. And then this very same week, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers is going to have a show on Teen Wolf, featuring Blake and myself once again. So we're doing a crossover event. This is very exciting. This is a first for our podcast.
Yes, it's like a mini series.
And you have to hear both parts to solve the mystery at the end of which one of us is the werewolf. Hint, it's Blake.
I'm probably the hairier one, so that makes sense.
But only because I shave myself every morning like a swimmer. So I'm excited to talk two different werewolf movies, especially Silver Bullet, because we fans of Silver Bullet are few in number, Blake. And I know that you are as much of a fan, if not more, of this movie as I am, correct?
I adore this movie. That's true.
So I'm excited to talk about it. Real quick, before we get into that, I should say this podcast is coming out on Wednesday, May 31st, which means tomorrow we kick off June Exploitation at fthismovie.net. It's our month-long celebration of exploitation and genre movies, which werewolf movies count. If you want to know about June, every day we have a different category. You watch a different kind of movie, and then we write about them and talk about them in the comments over at F This Movie. So if you want to know more about that, check out fthismovie.net and click on the June Exploitation tab. And how's everything going at Saturday Night Movie Sleepover, sir?
It's going pretty well. We're kind of gearing up for a very fun summer of movies.
Are you doing like a themed summer?
But in a rare twist, we've plotted out the whole summer. We know exactly what we're doing up until like fall. We may, you know, sometimes you switch, something comes up and you end up throwing a new one in and switching something out, but we have a lot. If we stay on course, we have a pretty exciting summer. Nothing specifically themed.
Okay.
But so far, for some reason, 2017 has been like the anniversary year. We've been doing, it's like 30th anniversary movies, 40th anniversary movies, 25th anniversary movies. We just did Over the Top. And I think that was a 30th anniversary.
87 was a big year for the kinds of movies that you guys talk about on that show.
Yeah, yeah. We did Reservoir Dogs recently, and then we did the 20th anniversary. I think we did Fifth Element.
Yeah.
So recently, so we've been doing a lot of that. It's been fun, but we're getting ready to go off into the summer of 2017 with a lot of hopefully fun sleepover type movies that everybody's going to enjoy.
That's very cool. I know, you know, you guys get brought up a lot in our kind of, we have a lot of crossover fans, I guess. We have people who listen to both shows, so this is an exciting week for them.
Some minds will be blown.
Let's just say you're welcome, everyone.
Crossing the streams.
All right, so before we talk about Silver Bullet, I will start the show the way that I often do and ask you, have you seen anything good lately?
Most recently, I've been asked to kind of guest on a bunch of podcasts this week. It's kind of one of those things where when it rains, it pours. So I've been doing the homework for that. And most recently, I just revisited most of John Carpenter's catalog to guest on the Wrong Reel podcast with James Hancock.
So, very cool. I like that show.
He's James is great. I've done his show a few times. We tackled the non-zombie Romero movies, and we did Buster Keaton, and this time we did John Carpenter, who's likely my favorite director, so yeah. It's exciting.
Was any new discoveries in going through his catalog again?
What I will say is it's really interesting every time I do his show, because we do such a, you know, we tackle so many movies on one podcast. So yeah. It's really interesting in the homework to watch them all like so close together, you know, like one right after the other, instead of having it all spread out. You start to really notice shots and things that, you know that Carpenter is an auteur and all that stuff. But when you see, you know, the beginning of Assault on Precinct 13 kind of mimicked in They Live during the police raid. And you start to see all like these motifs of like reality not being what you think it is. You know, when you see them all clustered into one, you know, week and a half of film viewing, you have a very different perspective on them.
Yeah.
Than just watching them occasionally.
Any new standouts, like a movie that you were maybe a little more lukewarm on before, and then watching it this time, you were like, no, wait, I was wrong. This movie's awesome.
No. I love all of his movies. I mean, his impact on me is like immeasurable. You know, he can't be measured. You know, his music and his movies were the direct thing that led to me writing a book. You know, when I fell in love with his movies and his music when I was a teenager,
yeah,
that kind of put me on the trajectory of falling in love with Goblin and then falling in love with film music. So nothing seemed lukewarm to me. If anything, it just reinforced my love and passion for his movies. You know, things like Christine. I just love that movie. And that's a highly underrated movie in his catalog, in my opinion. And I love the score for that movie. And Prince of Darkness is great. And even watching like Starman, you know, is what a beautiful movie.
Yeah.
From a guy that doesn't get to do that very often.
Right. I rewatched Christine last October, I think, and it was the first time I'd seen it in a long time. And I liked it way more than I remembered liking it. But I also remember being struck by, and I think this is just a thing about adaptation, it feels like it's missing a middle chunk where we see Arnie go from like nice to dick.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like Alexander Paul is all of a sudden like, Arnie, what's wrong? But we never saw her actually fall in love with nice Arnie. So all of a sudden it's like, wait, how did we get here?
Yeah. I can see that.
But it's a cool movie.
Yeah. It's kind of, it's also, I watch it. It's, I have very few actual movie traditions. I have two. On New Year's Eve, I try to watch Rocky because he fights on New Year's Day.
Okay.
And then Christine, Arnie buys Christine on the exact day I was born, September 12th, 1978. So I try to watch Christine on my birthday.
That is outstanding. That's awesome. Well, I'm excited to hear that. Do you have any idea when that show will be available?
It was pretty epic. I can't imagine what he's doing edit-wise. I mean, yeah. We definitely talked for like 3+ hours, so I don't know how much he's cutting out. He usually has a pretty quick turnaround, so okay. I wouldn't be surprised if it's up before this one goes up.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, everybody be on the lookout for that. They did a show on Toby Hooper a couple weeks ago that was like one of the best discussions of Toby Hooper I've ever heard, and made me feel so much better about my own love for Toby Hooper. Because
yeah.
It's nice.
I wonder who he had on to do that.
It was like a round table, and I don't remember who it was, yeah. But it was a really good discussion. So
because he frequently has a couple of guys that I went to film school with.
Oh, really?
Way back in the day, they have a website called Pink Smoke, and I know he has them on a lot.
Yeah,
I don't talk to them so much, but it sounds like if they were going to do a Toby Hooper episode, at least one of those guys would be.
Yeah, I feel like there was a Pink Smoke involved. I'm trying to think of what. Okay, so I just have two movies that I will talk about briefly. The first is Raw. Have you seen Raw by any chance?
I have not seen
it. It is not Eddie Murphy Raw. It is a new film. It's French. It did, you know, the whole festival circuit, and now it had just shown up on iTunes and VOD and stuff, and it's written and directed by Julia DeCorno. I don't know if I'm saying that right, but it's basically about a girl who goes off to college to be a veterinarian, and her sister is also there, and it's sort of a coming of age thing. It's sort of a sexual awakening thing. It also turns into cannibalism, and there's a scene of someone just eating part of a finger. I hope that's not a spoiler. It was like one of the hardest things to watch I've ever seen. And I've watched some gnarly shit, you know, some really gross stuff. And for some reason, this little tiny, because it looked like, yeah, that's probably what it would look like if somebody eating a finger. But I really liked the movie. It's really beautifully done.
I love the description. It was like, she goes to college, it's coming of age. There's cannibalism involved.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely takes a turn towards...
Sounds raw.
Cannibalism. Oh, it's raw. And then I watched this slasher movie from 1988 called Iced.
Huh.
Not ringing a bell.
That's one that has slipped by me.
Okay, no, you're fine, because I will occasionally visit the Code Red forums on Blu-ray.com because I'm fascinated by what goes on there. And there was a long discussion between the guy who owns and operates Code Red and just a fan who wanted this label to release the movie Iced, and then was offering to pay for part of it. They were going to partner, and they were going to, because he wanted Iced on Blu-ray so badly. And I never even heard of the movie. So I finally tracked it down. Like, this guy is willing to put up arguably tens of thousands of dollars to get this movie out on Blu-ray. What is it? And it's, you know, it's what it sounds like. It's a slasher movie at like a ski resort, and it is not good. And for the life of me,
not worth the investment for that guy.
I cannot imagine why someone would want that movie on Blu-ray.
Maybe he made the movie.
It's possible. he's posing as someone else. We gotta get this out.
I love this movie.
Yeah. I will say, I don't watch Iced, but I think if you go on YouTube, you can just search the last scene of Iced, which is one of the craziest endings in an 80s slasher movie. It makes no sense. It's right up there with, you know, the ending of the original Friday the 13th in terms of the logic involved. Not quite to Sleepaway Camp levels, but...
just shy
of a dick, basically. just missing one dick. But yeah, so I don't know. See Raw, don't see Iced.
Okay.
Yeah. Let's talk Silver Bullet.
All right.
You did a show on Silver Bullet, yes?
Yeah, it's actually, you know, it was one of the, it's the only like impromptu episode that we've ever done. It was literally, I watched it with a friend of mine who loves Silver Bullet. And I happened to bring the recorder down when I was hanging out with him, and we watched it. And I was like, fuck it, let's just talk about it. And so there was zero prep other than the fact that we were drunk and we had just watched the movie. And so we kind of released it as like a bonus episode for it wasn't our first Halloween, but I guess it was our second Halloween of doing the show, or October of doing the show. And we decided that for Halloween we were going to do – usually we do every other week. And we decided for October we were going to do a horror movie every week. And so it actually worked out pretty good because there was five Fridays that October. And so we kind of needed a fifth one because of scheduling and stuff. So I had this sleepover camp sleepaway camp, fuck man, it's the Silver Bullet quote one kind of in my back pocket. Luckily the guy I did it with, Dave, who's a, you know, one of my best friends, and he's a big avid Stephen King fan. And so even though we kind of just did it off the cuff between the two of us, we did end up doing a fairly you know, informative podcast.
Right.
But that was a long time ago, and nobody goes back to listen to the old shit. So.
Well, I was back and forth. I'm like, I decided not to listen to it. I was going to, and then I thought, well, no, because I don't want to just repeat stuff that you guys talked about. So I opted not to listen to it. So now I'm going to listen to it after we record this show. and then just be like, damn it, why didn't we say that?
I haven't listened to it since then, so I'm sure some of it will be brought up and then some of it might not be.
Right.
And also, because there was absolutely no prep involved, there's probably a lot of like false information.
Oh, please. There's going to be on this too. This is going to be riddled with inaccuracies. That's actually the tagline for our show. What came first for you, Silver Bullet or Cycle of the Werewolf?
Oh, Silver Bullet. I knew it was based on something by Stephen King, but I didn't even, you know, realize what that really was until much, much later. My story of my first time seeing Silver Bullet is kind of a great one if you think about the circumstance, if you put yourself in my shoes, which was I was at the time I was living in upstate New York. Well, not even that far upstate, but just north of Albany. And my development that I lived in was basically this one street that drove – you went into the development and then you went down this big long hill. And then at the bottom of the hill, there was like a circular block. And then surrounding the development was just woods. So probably like an autumn evening, I was up the hill at a friend of mine's house. And his parents were watching Silver Bullet. And we sat there and we watched it. And then it got late and I had to go home. And then I had to walk home in the dark down this huge hill. Just like with woods surrounding the street. And I walked home and I was so freaked out. I mean, I was probably like 11 or 12. I certainly wasn't older than 13. And I got really freaked out. And it was one of those things where like I tried to then just to make it go faster, I tried to run, but it was a pretty steep hill. And you know, when you're trying to like run down a hill, you kind of just like lose control because of momentum. And so it's always stuck out as being an interesting viewing experience for me because of that long walk home,
right?
With woods just out of, you know, just off the side of the road.
I don't remember the first time I saw it. I know as a kid, I used to, anytime I would go to our public library, I would go to the Stephen King section and see if Cycle of the Werewolf was on the shelf, and it often wasn't, and I wouldn't even check it out. I would just flip through it and look at the gory Bernie Wrightson pictures.
Yeah.
May he rest in peace. And so that was like some of the coolest werewolf stuff ever, because I was way into werewolves when I was a kid. That was definitely my favorite monster, probably still is. But I don't know that I connected the two things in my head, and I'm sure I saw Silver Bullet a bunch of times growing up because I was pretty familiar with it, but I remember watching it on DVD probably around the time it came out, so maybe early 2000s, and it was the first time I'd seen it in years. And I was watching it with a friend and just way into it, just really like, this movie's so much better than I remember. And I had always liked it, but for some, you know, I was watching it as an adult now and appreciating filmmaking things instead of just, I like the story about the kid and the werewolf. And it gets to the end and we get the voiceover and the freeze frame. And my friend laughed, and I suddenly felt very protective of the movie because I was like, why are you laughing at that? That's awesome. That's beautiful. Like, this is To Kill a Mockingbird. How dare you make fun of this movie? And so that was, I think, the moment where Silver Bullet and I became one.
Well, like you, I really, werewolves as a pretty young kid were that the whole thing with the werewolves was like my introduction into horror. Like mid to late 80s, I was just fucking obsessed with werewolves. You know, in 87, that show Werewolf came out on Fox, and I was so into that. And my mom would take me to the public library, and I would just take out all these books about werewolves and I would make my mom take them to work and like photocopy pages for me, so that I had this collection of like photocopied pages about werewolf lore. And I also share a love for werewolf things. And although I feel that there aren't a whole lot of really great werewolf movies,
every time I think there are, I'm like, yeah, because there's, and I name like four or five, and then I kind of run out.
I don't even know if I can name that many.
Wolfman, obviously.
Yeah. I do love the Wolfman. I feel like the ending is, you know, had potential that they didn't go for. But I do like the Wolfman.
And true. I'm a fan of Frankenstein meets the Wolfman, although I recognize there's not much of Frankenstein meeting the Wolfman in it. And then we jump ahead to, you know, The Howling, American Werewolf, Silver Bullet.
My thing with The Howling, and I like The Howling, but my thing with The Howling is, like, it could be anything.
Like,
it doesn't really need to be a werewolf. It just could be, like, any monster.
I think I like the werewolf design so much because I'm real picky about my werewolves. I want them to walk on two legs, which, I mean, I love American Werewolf, don't get me wrong, but that was always a little bit of a roadblock for me, especially as a kid, because it didn't look like how I wanted a werewolf to look.
You don't look right.
Exactly. Just swap out the werewolf from The Howling with American Werewolf, and it's, now we're talking a perfect movie. And then I start to run out a little bit. I mean, there are some other ones that I like. I kind of dig Bad Moon.
Okay, yeah.
Good werewolf in that.
My love for this movie started, I don't know, maybe within the last 6 or 7 years, just like kind of revisiting it like you did.
Yeah.
Maybe even just catching it on cable or something.
They show it a lot during Monster Fest on AMC.
Yeah. There was a period where I had like Showtime, and there was like one channel on Showtime that had like the best. They're all movies that I owned, but it was still awesome to see like Suspiria and Halloween 3, you know, on television.
I do. I have multiple copies of The Funhouse, but when it shows up on HBO, I'm like, ooh, nice. I'm going to watch this whole thing.
Yeah. But, so just revisit, seeing it again, it was just like you, I kind of just absolutely fell in love with it. And I've seen it, I don't know how many times since then, because it's, I've come to terms with the fact that it might be one of my favorite movies.
It's pretty great. Let me ask, even though, like I said, I'm picky about werewolves, I think Silver Bullet has one of the worst werewolves.
Yeah. Last time I was on, this is how
that's, that's what we talked about.
This is kind of how the genesis of us doing this was. With five minutes to go on the last time.
I started shitting on the Silver Bullet werewolf. I know, like, it's largely the result of some production issues, right?
That's what they say. They say that King really wanted it to be kind of ambiguous or plain, whatever that means. And
like that you never quite see it, right? Just
yeah, well, until the end. Yeah, but then in the end you kind of do. And like Dino De Laurentiis was supposedly really upset with it, like really hated the way it looked and was like, you have to change it. And both King and Rambaldi, Carlo Rambaldi, who designed it, were like, no, we're not changing it. So they just kind of put their foot down, and so they kind of got stuck with the werewolf that they got. And it also ended up being apparently very late into the filmmaking process. Was it even finished?
The whole movie seems plagued by weird production stories. There's a director replacement. There's, you know, issues with the werewolf. And so, again, it's one of these kind of miracles that the movie is as good as it is. But why is it, do you think, that we love it and yet most people maybe don't? I think in time people have come around on it. And now it's, I think, better respected than it was certainly in 85. But I remember a long time where if you said, I really love Silver Bullet, people would, even horror fans would kind of look at you sideways.
Yeah. Well, the whole thing with the internet and then DVD distribution and even late VHS distribution with places like Anchor Bay Entertainment and, everything getting kind of put out again, like the popularity of horror in general and people having access to things, has really been amazing. I mean, even just doing this Carpenter podcast with James for The Wrong Reel, I was talking about, like, when I loved Carpenter, like, people shit on The Fog and Prince of Darkness, and They Live was, you know, people liked it, but for kitsch value. And now, like, people write books about They Live, right, you know? Right. And so it's been like this really crazy thing to watch over the last 20 years, how everything that, you know, we loved, or, you know, how we're falling in love with now, has gone from being hated to, in some cases, being like revered. And even like, I've done another podcast, a horror podcast called Hell Bound for Horror. And he was asking me, you know, pick a movie from like each decade that you think is kind of underappreciated that you love. And I was like, I have no idea what's underappreciated.
Well, right.
You know, like when I fell in love with these movies, they were all underappreciated.
Right. And know, now like almost nothing. And now almost nothing is,
yeah,
you know,
it's like, no, nobody had seen Peeping Tom. Like, I don't know. Do people know Peeping Tom now, yeah, or Martin by Romero? Now it's like everything's available at everybody's fingertips. So I have no idea what's, you know, isn't seen,
right,
and stuff. But so I would imagine that you're right in that, like, people, the fans of Silver Bullet are finding each other and banding together and support
recording podcasts. It's a weird double-edged sword. And I think I've talked about this before, but it's great that films and filmmakers are sort of being reassessed and appreciated. Like you said, I mean, almost every Carpenter movie has taken 10 to 20 years for people to catch up to. And, you know, with the exception of Halloween, but even The Thing was a bomb, you know, when it came out. And yet the downside of that for me is that now anything that's 10 or more years old is suddenly being called an underappreciated gem, where it's like, now we get think pieces on like why Valentine is secretly great. And I'm like, I don't know if Valentine is, just because it's 15 years old now. The movie hasn't gotten better necessarily. It's just the time has passed. But with enough time, it seems like when it comes to horror, with enough time passing, people start to embrace every movie, just like,
yeah.
I don't know.
But to answer your question about like why, what is it about this movie that, you know, we love it, but there seems to be kind of like the majority of people don't really care for it. And it's one of the most like earnest, like heartfelt horror movies, I think, like in existence. And it's but there's this weird balance of that with kind of like this campy kitschiness of lines like, you know, you're going to make lemonade in your pants. And, well, you know, and then a not great looking werewolf. And
right.
I think the people that maybe gravitate towards it, at least for me, you know, like, especially as I get older, like I'm a big sap. And like, I just absolutely love this like love triangle of like this kid and his sister and his crazy uncle. And it's just like, I love it to death. And if that doesn't appeal to people, and I would imagine that there's a large population of horror fans that aren't interested in that.
Yeah.
And so like, that's this movie's strength. I mean, this movie has like nothing else going on for it. If you're not going to just totally fall in love with this kid in a wheelchair and his kind of stubborn sister who ends up coming around on him because of this crazy thing happening in town. And then this uncle who's, you know, that crazy like alcoholic uncle, but, you know, loves this kid, you know, more than anything. And so, I mean, that's why I love it. And I think that just doesn't appeal to some people, at least, especially for people looking for like a gory.
Right. It is weirdly, it feels like two movies kind of fighting with each other, and I'm on board for both of them. But like you, what makes me keep coming back to the movie is the sincerity and is all the relationship stuff and all the family stuff. And I enjoy the horror tropes that the movie embraces. And I think a lot of it is actually really well directed. A lot of the horror stuff is really well directed, and we'll talk about that in a couple minutes probably. But that stuff feels like a different movie. Those kind of stock characters who form the posse and go out looking for the werewolf and have those goofy lines, and all of a sudden the movie becomes really kind of gory and crazy, and then it goes back to this almost syrupy family drama. But I love the family drama stuff. And I wrote a piece about it a couple years ago and had to reread it because I was like, I don't remember what I said about this movie. But one of the things that I pointed out was that one of the things that I like about the movie so much is that in addition to just being concerned about the character's safety because they're being chased and possibly killed by a werewolf, that there are these kind of emotional stakes as well. We want the brother and sister to make up after the pantyhose incident. We're worried that Red is going to disappoint his nephew. We want Red and his sister to get along, you know? And so we're invested in all that stuff. And then the werewolf stuff is, it's almost like werewolf gravy.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which, by the way, remind me to give you the recipe for werewolf gravy.
It sounds disgusting.
I'll tell you what, it's delicious about 2 days a month. And then the rest of the time you don't really want to eat it because it's basically just brown water.
Sounds very musky.
Yeah.
And the funny, you know, the interesting thing is that all that stuff that we love about it, like, isn't in Cycle of the Werewolf.
No, like, right.
For the most part, Cycle of the Werewolf is just this month by month account of like the Cycle of the Werewolf started as an idea that they were going to create this calendar where King would write like 500 words per month, and then each month would have a picture drawn by Bernie Wrightson, and then King just couldn't write that little, so it ended up developing into what they at the time called the novelette. Now it's called the novella. But all that is just about the werewolf and kind of like the town hysteria about what's going on. And even though Marty and his sister and Uncle Red, who's like Uncle Al in the book, are in it, it's a very small part of that. And you don't get any of this. I mean, I don't even know if her name is Jane in the book. It might be, but like, she's just like a bitch.
it's Kate in the book, I believe.
Oh, Kate in the book, yeah. But she's like, I mean, you get why she kind of dislikes her brother, and all of that is in the movie, but we don't get that kind of turnaround of how they end up making up and become close through this ordeal. So it's interesting that, you know, what you and I connect with this is not in the source material.
Yeah.
That was all kind of created for this.
And I think the movie does such a nice job of setting those things up. You know, Stephen King is not always the most economical storyteller. And I wouldn't even say that his screenplay for this is economical. But, you know, that scene with the snake in the tree and Jane falling down sets up so much of the dynamic between them and does such a good job of establishing how she's felt about Marty her whole life. And
yeah, yeah.
I think it's just such a, I think the movie is so full of good scenes like that. I mean, I can't believe that the movie takes a beat just for that scene between Red and Marty's mom. And, you know, Marty's mom is not in the movie that much, but the fact that it pauses for that scene between them where she basically says, I'm afraid you're going to hurt him because he looks up to you so much, I think is so, I think it sets the movie apart from so many other horror movies of the 80s or even horror movies today.
Yeah.
That it takes the time to set up these kind of emotional stakes, you know, in the span of a single scene.
Well, that scene in particular, I mean, there's a lot of these great moments. There's that one. There's the one that you kind of mentioned where, because of what happened with the snake, she falls and kind of ruins her clothes and gets a hole in her stockings or her pantyhose. And then, you know, in the middle, you know, kind of, you don't know what time it is, but she's trying to fall asleep, and
right.
Marty comes in and puts money on her dresser, and she's like, "What's this for?" And he's like, "Well, so for you to buy some new hose." There's so many. You're right. There are so many of like these little beautiful gems, but the one in between Gary Busey and the woman playing his sister, like apparently that was all improvisation, like on set. And they went to Dan Attias, who directed the movie, went to King and said, you know, we have this scene that we did you know, me and the actors kind of came up with the scene, and King was like, yeah, it's great. Sure. Keep it. You know, like, I don't mind putting my name on that. So you wonder, like, how much, apparently a lot of what Busey was doing was improvised. I mean, he would do it for the script, and then he would do takes where he improvised, and they liked his improvisation so much that they ended up using a lot of them. But part, I think why all that stuff works so much is because the three of them, Gary Busey, Corey Haim, and Megan Follows, who plays his sister Jane, they're so good in it too. Like, they're like, they really pull it off. I mean, this is like maybe Busey's best part. I mean, he's so good.
Yeah, it would
be
like this or Buddy Holly, I think, honestly. I agree. I think he's so good in this movie, and it almost makes me sad watching it because he has become such a punchline, sort of. But he is good. I mean, he's such a force of nature while still being somebody that you understand caring about, and a character that you love, even though he's kind of a crazy person. That scene where he's leaving the table, they're all together for a barbecue when he gives Marty the fireworks. There's a, 2 minutes where they're at the table and he's leaving. And I was watching it today just being like, oh, all of this is improvised for sure. And I'm just trying to watch the other actors reacting to Gary Busey, like just not knowing what he's going to do. And
even like the girl's name who,
he calls her some weird thing.
Some crazy name. Yeah. Like, there's no way that's what that
He just made up a name for her. It's like, all right. Yeah, that's in the movie.
He's like, bye, Gypsy, or what? some weird.
Yes.
Name. Yeah, he's so good in it. And but also, it's tough to want to look at this a movie like this and kind of analyze it for any real meaning. But when you do, I mean, it's got depth. I mean, in essence, it's a movie about kind of like handicap. Obviously Marty, he's handicapped, he's in a wheelchair, but even Red, like, he's got his own kind of handicap. Mm-hmm. I mean, self-destructive, he's an alcoholic, he's going through wives, and that's the thing, that's what his sister is so scared of, is that, God forbid, I mean, the one person that doesn't have like pity for himself over his handicap is Marty. I mean, Marty's, other than one moment where he's watching kids, one moment of vulnerability where he's watching kids play baseball, is the only time we see that, like, he even thinks about that he's in a wheelchair. And then on the other side, Reverend Lowe, his handicap is that he's this crazy fucking werewolf and he doesn't know how to deal with it. You know, he's kind of like justifying it to himself that he's doing like the Lord's work, but he's, as the movie's progressing, he's just going like more mad and kind of crazy. So it's like this weird trifecta of people with, their own kind of baggage and handicaps, and how they all kind of they're intertwined as characters.
The stuff about doing the Lord's work gets dropped pretty quickly. Like, it's interesting when we get the first werewolf attack against the woman who's pregnant and going to commit suicide. And in case you don't know, she flat out says, I'm going to hell, I'm committing suicide, and I'm pregnant.
And
she reminds
you, which is even worse.
Right. As double she's doing suicide. It. Hey, audience, remember? And so then she's killed. And so, like, oh, that's interesting. Is this going to be a werewolf that kills sinners? But then that essentially never happens again. And even at the end of the movie, when he's sort of talking that through, he essentially only names her as being a case where he's like, look, I did something good. It's like, yeah, but that was one of like 20.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could apply it more. I mean, the little girl's father, he's certainly not a redeemable character, whether he deserves to die
because he's watching
for being
wrestling,
like a drunk and an asshole. I don't know. Brady, he likes to kill bugs and he's a bit of a dick.
It is. I mean, yes, we could say like, okay, everyone sins. But when the movie goes so far out of its way to be like, here's the sin she's committing, and then to never do it. again, it's not a flaw in the movie. I just thought it was interesting that it starts to develop this idea and then pretty quickly abandons it to just have random victims, you know?
Yeah. Well, I you know, look, if you really want to analyze it, I mean, you could find meaning. I mean, like I said, he clearly is like losing his mind by the end of the movie. I mean, he's just played out, got to murder Corey Haim.
You know? But he's going to make it look like an accident, which I appreciate. Not enough werewolves do that.
You know, so you could, it could be that, like, you know, in the beginning he was, you know, that was his intention. And as he gets kind of spiraled further into the madness of the wolf, you know, those lines start to get crossed. But I also think it's like, you know, if it's a guy who has devoted himself to the Lord and is a monster of you know, mortal sin, you know, I could see him trying to justify it to himself, whether he's right or not.
Right. Well, and I like, you know, there's a moment later in the film where I think he's starting to transform. I can't remember. And he says, "It's not my fault." And I just think that's so interesting because you don't really hear that articulated in most werewolf movies. It's more either about embracing the monster that I am or the sort of heavy-hearted guilt, which we get that as well, especially in that dream sequence. But it's more about sort of the torture of being a werewolf. But we don't really get a character who's like, hey, don't blame me for this. I can't control this. This was done to me. And again, it's not necessarily developed, but just him saying that one line for me is enough to make it stand out from a lot of other werewolf movies.
Yeah. Let me ask you, because it's been so long, I have no idea what I thought of it the first time I saw it in terms of, does that dream, do you think, tip off to a first time viewer, spoiler alert, that he's the werewolf? Or are you really not supposed to know it's him until Janie comes with the bottles? Because it certainly seems like they're trying to play it like it's this big reveal.
Right. I guess, yeah, I don't know, because I don't remember my experience either. So every time I watch it, I feel like it's sort of three reveals. That the dream sequence is the moment where it's revealed to the audience that he's the werewolf. That the eye patch, you know, is sort of the reveal to Janie. And then at the end, when he transforms back into the Reverend, that it's sort of the reveal to Uncle Red. Honestly, it didn't occur to me that the dream sequence technically doesn't spell out that he's the werewolf, but you're right, it doesn't.
Yeah, I just wonder, like, I don't know. I kind of, you know, it could be, you could look at it and interpret it as, you know, every, you know, he's the only one in the thing that's not the werewolf.
Right. Right.
So in the dream that he's the only one that's not a werewolf in the dream. So maybe he's not the werewolf, but it seems like such a clear indicator, but we already know that he is now exactly, when we watch it. So it's hard to know.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, that never occurred to me, but yeah, that the way that it's revealed that his eye is covered up is played like such a reveal, even to the camera.
Yeah,
that you're probably right. That probably is supposed to be the reveal. I like the fact that, you know, Janie kind of finds out that she believes Marty pretty quickly, and that she finds out before the end of the movie that it's not just 90 minutes of you got to believe me. See, I was right, that it does give him at least one ally. And I like that scene. Yeah, the more I think about it now, I don't think that dream is supposed to be a tip-off, because I was so appreciating it today as I was watching it. As she goes around collecting cans, you know, we get these moments of suspense as each character reveals they have two eyes. And I was like, well, this is so interesting that he's playing it so suspensefully, because we already know it's the Reverend, but she doesn't. So that's a really cool choice. And now I'm like, oh, wait, no, that was probably for our benefit, not hers.
Damn it. Well, you know, it's hard to know,
right?
You know, especially, you know, I was pretty young when I saw it the first time, so I didn't even know if I would have picked up on it, even if
And I do love the way that the dream sequence, I think it goes a little bit off the rails. Again, I think because of some spotty special effects. But I love the way it starts. It's such a smart choice because it opens on Brady's dad kind of glaring. And we just assume there's no indication that it's a dream. Because we see that, and the language of the movie is telling us, okay, yes, Brady is still, his dad is still grieving and he's angry. And so that's how we interpret that.
Yeah, we've already seen a funeral scene
right,
like this one.
And so I like that it doesn't tip off right away that it's a dream in the way that it sort of slowly builds to that. Another thing I have to point out, too, as we're talking about the movie giving a lot of screen time over to characters' emotions and what they're going through, Brady's dad gets scenes where he's just worried. I mean, Brady is just this little side victim character, and yet we get multiple scenes of first he's worried, has anyone seen my son? And then we get the reaction where he's horrified, and then we get the funeral where he's grieving. Like, the movie gives time over to the family of a victim, and we sort of see the effect that it has on a person, which rarely happens in horror movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the movie is definitely a bit of an anomaly, I think. And I think that's why, you know, all those things are why I love it. And I think why you love it. I mean, it's, like I said, it's a very emotional movie. It's a very, like, this movie's all heart.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways. And And there's just not a lot of horror movies like that in period, not just for like the time period, you know, not just for the 80s, but just, you know, you have sympathetic killer movies like Martin or Maniac or, I mean, there's movies that play on emotion in a certain way, but not the way this one does. I mean, and it's funny, when last time we talked, and you even kind of said it this time, but last time when I was on the show and you were like, it's like To Kill a Mockingbird with a werewolf. And it's funny, because like in kind of researching, I found out, and I don't know if you knew this, and that's why you kind of make that association, but that's why King wrote the screenplay, was because he was watching To Kill a Mockingbird.
Oh, I did not know that. I just assumed it because of the the voiceover. You
yeah,
know, the...
and he said, and he, because apparently Dino De Laurentiis was trying to get him to write the script, and he was like, I don't want to write the script. And then he was watching To Kill a Mockingbird on TV, and he was like, huh, like, what if we treat this movie with narration like that? And it's like looking back at this, you know, year of craziness from Janie's point of view.
Right.
And that was actually his inspiration to actually sit down and write it, and why there's narration in this movie.
All right. Well, yeah. Well, that's one of the things that the movie sometimes gets knocked for, but I really like it.
I love the narration. Yeah. I mean, I honestly don't think I would like it as much without it. Like, even if you had like kind of the same movie and gave that information in a different kind of more cinematic way, there's something about the narration in this movie that it just works, and it's beautifully written. I love, you know, the first half of the movie, we don't hear a lot of it. We hear it in the very beginning, and
right,
then we don't hear it again until Janie's collecting the bottles, kind of
right,
searching for the one-eyed person. And then, you know, and then I love when they go to the guy to make the bullet, and she's like, Uncle Red said he was an old world's craftsman. It's just like, it's just schmaltzy enough for me that it's just like, I really fall in love with it.
Well, it comes down to that last scene, like, you're either my friend who laughed at I Love You, Marty freeze frame, or you're me who's like, that's beautiful. And if you're on board for that, the voiceover works for you. And if you're not, you know, King gets hammered a lot of times for some of his kind of schmaltziness. And I feel like there are a great deal of fans of his even that prefer him in that kind of bleaker, like the mist mode, unless it's, you know, a property that isn't really horror, if it's Stand By Me or something, that we're okay with it. But again, I like that he's able to indulge that side of himself here, And I think, you know, that decision to make it told through Janie's perspective is a huge part of what makes the movie work, because, you know, there's another version of this movie that's 100% told through Marty's eyes, and I don't think that movie works nearly as well.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it sets it up. It sets up kind of like the outlandishness of it. Having the narration, I think it automatically puts us in like a fairy tale. You know, it's a story being told to us. So I think maybe as a viewer, subconsciously, like, we're willing to kind of go with this crazy story, in that it's this it ends up being a recollection, but it's an oral telling of a story. And I think I really like that about it. And I think it also for me helps me forgive some of the kitschiness, or maybe not like the corniness of some of the other stuff going on.
Sure.
And the other thing is, like, originally the original intention was to plug my book. I interviewed Jay Chataway for my book, who did the music for this movie. So we talked a bit about this movie, because I love the score as well as I love this movie. And he told me that originally it was going to be like a PG-13, like kid adventure type movie. And then both De Laurentiis and also the studio, which I think was maybe Paramount, they watched it and they're like, no, like, this need, we need to get an R out of this. I mean, that, you know, nobody's going to see a horror movie for like a kid story, you know, like, we need blood. And so they went back and they did a bunch of reshoots for all the horror stuff and, you know, the murders, and added a lot of blood and kind of made it all really graphic. And with the narration and put it into that perspective, I feel like it becomes much more of a, you know, if it was that movie, it's much more along the lines of something like Neverending Story.
Sure.
You know,
yeah.
But not as, obviously not as much fantasy, but this kind of kid's story that was, you know, because fairy tales are kind of fucked up. I mean, they're scary. That's like the purpose that they, that's their purpose.
Right.
Is to, you know, help kids deal with the world and fear, like, from the comfort of their bed from with their parents before they get out in the real world, and then are like really freaked out by, like, you know, it's like the vaccine of, you know, like, you get a little bit. I mean, that's kind of like, they do serve a purpose for childhood development. And so seeing, you know, having this movie be that, you know, I think the voiceover or the VO and stuff sounds, you know, makes a little bit more sense.
And it was kind of common in the 80s. And that's one of the things that I think is so special about 80s movies. And I'm sure you could speak to this as a host of, you know, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers, but that there were these movies being made, you know, that were PG rated, that were theoretically targeted, not necessarily at kids, unless we're talking like Return to Oz, but kind of for anyone, and yet they could be really dark and kind of fucked up, and there was a sense of danger to them that those movies don't exist anymore. You know, there's such a divide now, I think, between this stuff is made for kids and this stuff is PG-13. You know, that middle ground is gone, and the PG-13 is supposed to be the family movie, but it's, you know, Transformers and all that shit. And we've kind of sanitized all that weirdness and darkness, and Silver Bullet absolutely feels like a movie that is a little bit fighting with itself. And when you say, you know, they wanted it to be this one thing, you can almost feel them going back and inserting those sequences of gore and werewolf attacks, because honestly, some of them move the story forward a little bit, but if you were to remove a couple of them, you know, this is a PG or a PG-13 movie, and I don't think it's a worse movie. I think those scenes are handled well. in particular, that scene kind of on the moors, the fog scene with the mob. Like,
yeah.
I think they're very well directed, but they don't need to be in the movie. They feel inserted there to add a scene of horror and violence.
Yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, you're right. I mean, it's starting in the 70s. Kind of Disney started that with like the messed up kids movies.
Yeah.
Things like Watcher in the Woods and Black Hole.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, I mean, like Gremlins is incredibly messed up, but yet it was certainly marketed with toys and stuff to children. I mean,
it has Steven Spielberg's name. Go take your family. You know, like this is the guy who made E.T.
That period is the period of fucked up Steven Spielberg.
Yes. Poltergeist was PG. A man peels his face off.
E.T. is incredibly messed up, you know.
Yeah.
You know, even like Temple of Doom was really screwed up. I mean, I had a friend who said, you know, like, I can't wait till, you know, decades and decades from now when Spielberg is like a really old guy and somebody does like the Truffaut Hitchcock book, but with Spielberg, and then it's revealed like how messed up Spielberg really is. But he's like too old to know better not to talk about like how much he hates children.
Why is it, you know, I know a little bit about, say his name again. I've always said Daniel Attias. Is it Attias?
I think it's Attias, but who knows?
I'll say Attias.
Like you, I mean, Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers is the worst with names.
So let's say Attias. This is the only feature he ever made. And I can't figure out why. He's directed a ton of TV. He continues to make TV and has worked for big shows. You know, he did a lot of Alias, 6 Feet Under, The Sopranos, The Wire, The Walking Dead.
He worked on 21 Jump Street.
Yeah.
One of my favorite shows.
A ton of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. I love 21 Jump Street, by the way. So he's basically done some work on every HBO show. So he's a big TV guy, but this is the only feature he's ever made. And I'm so fascinated by that because I think it's a really well-directed film and I can't figure out why this was the only time he got kind of a chance to do that.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think his career before this was mainly as an assistant director. And then he did this. And yeah, I mean, he's one of like the most prolific TV directors that we've ever come across. Because there's a lot of directors that we do on like on our show when we do the movies that we do. Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, this guy did a lot of TV up into this, or he did a lot of TV after this. But when you look at like this guy's IMDb page, you're right. I mean, it's like from the 80s to now, he's directed some of the biggest shows. I mean, he did like an episode of The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
And then he directed episodes of like Briscoe County Jr. So he did awesome shows.
Right. Yeah. Right. But also Dr. Quinn, you know, so he's all over the place.
Yeah. 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 I don't know. He worked the way he just, who knows why people go the way they do. Maybe just TV was what he was offered. And then he's stuck in TV land.
Well, again, for years in my head, when I knew that this was not a particularly well-respected movie and I hadn't yet revisited it, I was like, oh, well, he never really made another movie because, you know, people didn't like this one and it's maybe not that good. And then I watched it and I'm like, no, wait, this movie's awesome. And why was this guy not making a ton of movies? I mean, I had read in some places that Don Coscarelli actually shot some of this movie, but Coscarelli himself has said,
yeah,
no, he was out, you know, at the pre-production stage.
And if you hear, yeah, I mean, there's a lot of contradicting stories about that. There's stories that say that basically Coscarelli directed the whole entire movie. Minus the werewolf stuff.
Yeah.
But he's said no. And if you hear Attias talk about it, about the movie, I mean, he talks about it like he was there for like all the shooting. I mean, he talks about like how he and Gary Busey and the actress that played the mother came up with that scene. And he talks about stuff in the development stage. So it seems like he came on pretty early.
Yeah. And again, as I was rewatching it today, I mean, you really see him, every scene is designed. I mean, obviously every scene is designed for a specific impact, but it's not this kind of generic filmmaker for hire approach. I mean, he really composes some really cool shots. All the emotional stuff works. I just think he does such a good job, and I'm just bummed out, I guess, that we didn't see more any films from him, but in particular horror films, you know.
We didn't get Silver Bullet 2, T-O-O.
Oh, boy. Save it for the next podcast. T-O-O. God damn it. Why is there no big debate? You know, I love Tobe Hooper, right? And I'm constantly having to argue with people. You know, Spielberg directed Poltergeist. Where are the people who are like, you know, Coscarelli made Silver Bullet? And why is that not such a controversy?
Well, one thing I can say about Poltergeist is because I also interviewed Alan Howarth for my book. And so We talked about his sound design work on his post-production sound work. And according to him, like by the time the film got to post-production, Hooper was already on to the next movie. So at least in post-production, Spielberg really was the guy, cutting the movie.
That seemed to be Tobe Hooper's move there for a while. He walked off a lot of movies.
Sometimes he just doesn't like the edit room.
During production, like, and then, often during the editing, he just...
Some directors love the editing room, hate production. Hooper loves the production, hates the editing room.
I was paying special attention to the score, obviously, because I remembered you had talked to Jay Chataway as I was watching it today, and... I was going to pull the book off the shelf and reread it, and then I was like, no, I'll just ask you. Why did you guys talk about kind of why he went with a... There's sections that are like a synthesizer score, which feel a little out of place to me with it being a period film. I mean, the more sort of orchestral theme totally works and is really lovely, but then especially during some of like the horror scenes or the werewolf scenes, it gets real... synthesizer,
like 80s synthy.
We
didn't talk about that, and I think because honestly before this viewing, like, I never really paid to the attention to the fact that it doesn't take place in the 80s,
right?
And I was like, oh, even when I was watching it today, I was like, huh, yeah, I didn't never really realize that this is like this takes place in the late 70s. I think it was just, I mean, it's tough to call because I mean, clearly there was a big enough budget to have like an orchestra.
Right.
But maybe there wasn't enough. I mean, most of those decisions get made because of some kind of constraint or restraint, in terms of budget or time. It's also like he talked a lot about how I think it was they were just starting the sampling was becoming a thing. And like the at that point by 85, kind of the synthesizers were really kind of coming into their own. And so they went and recorded. He had a sound guy go out to like a wolf sanctuary and record a bunch of wolves. And then they loaded those sounds into the synthesizer. And so some of what you're hearing is actually like augmented wolf howls and stuff that they actually recorded.
That's cool.
And worked into the score. And I think it's more a product of the time than of when it's made. But yeah, that's a good question that I wish I realized that this wasn't a movie that took place in the 70s when I did interview.
I just assumed it was modern. I was like, use your cell phone, kid. What the fuck?
Chataway has... He didn't do a lot of horror movies, but the ones that he did, like he did Maniac, the original score for Maniac, the Maniac Cop movies, but especially with Maniac and Silver Bullet. The thing I've always connected with Chataway's music, and one of the reasons why I wanted to talk to him for my book, even though he's not at this point, he's more well known for the work he's done for the Star Trek TV shows, like Next Generation, Voyager, and all those, than he is for the horror movies that he did. But I've always really loved his stuff because he has a way of inserting that like heart, you know, that that sensitivity into a horror score. And I think he was like the perfect person to do this one because of that. It's funny, in the book, when we start talking about this score, we had already in the interview had already talked about Maniac, and then he makes this connection. He's like, oh, for horror movies, I always use a wooden flute sound. He's like, I never really thought about it until you just asked me this question right now. But like, that's his go-to like sentimental instrument. And so like, I just love the score because it really does. I mean, the movie itself is, like we were talking about, kind of this weird, has this weird duality of being this werewolf terrorizing a town, and then this kind of like family melodrama, and like nobody does that quite as well as Jay Chataway does.
Well, his score, you know, is another one of those things that kind of makes the movie feel like To Kill a Mockingbird. And I so appreciate, not that the themes sound similar, but just that the movie kind of goes with an orchestral theme as opposed to, hey, this is a period piece, here's a bunch of, you know, American Graffiti style needle drops. And because that obviously now has become the shorthand for, this is in the 70s, here's some songs from the 70s, hey, listen, you know, Slow Ride is playing, so you know this is in the 70s. And so I like, you know, the movie doesn't feel timeless as a result, because I do feel like it feels like a period piece. It feels like a memory, like a story being told, and using, you know, 70s rock or something would have, I think, stepped all over that kind of feeling. And his score, I think, really helps sell that idea.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's very, I mean, it's, for lack of a better word, I mean, it's a little sappy at times, but that's,
oh, for sure.
But it works for me.
Right.
You know? That's one of the things I love. Doo-dee-doo.
The wooden flute.
It's, yeah. And then there's the, you know, a very 80s pop song to the theme during the end credits. You know, it's classic.
What they needed was the Silver Bullet rap.
Yeah, well, that didn't start yet, but yes, it would have been great if there was like sound bites and a really bad rap about a werewolf. And
I was recently re-listening to, I think it was the Masters of the Universe episode you guys did, and I swear there's like 20 minutes at the beginning about movies with like the rap songs over the end credits that tell the story of the movie.
Yeah, we get off on tangents. It's tough because I'm always worried that the tangents are going to turn off listeners, but we do get a lot of listeners that are like, no, we love that you guys go off on crazy tangents. Yeah. So
yeah. One thing I've learned is, you know, new listeners may come and go, but the people who love the show love it for what it is. And so you have to just embrace like the show that you do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. There's a part of me that entertains the idea of like my next book will be about rap songs about the movies.
That would be outstanding. That would be. I got to talk to the guy who did T-U-R-T-L-E Power.
Yeah, well, we did. We talked a lot of, probably had an equally long conversation about the same topic when we did the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle movie.
How can you not? Just the fact that the song gets it wrong, that Raphael is the leader of the group.
Yes, nobody was paying attention.
Exactly. Like, how do you make your rap song? And then that was one of the things I really enjoyed about Wolf Cop a couple years ago. I don't know if you saw Wolf Cop.
Yeah, yeah.
That it had a rap song over the end credits.
Yeah.
The Wolf
Cop, you know,
rap.
Kind of... there's a couple of times I try to bring something like that back, you know, even like, I don't know if it was a rap song, but that movie, that comedy from a number of years ago, that is totally watchable, Accepted with,
Justin Long.
There's some kind of song at the end that has sound bites from the movie. That's kind of talking about the plot of the movie.
Now I need to rewatch Accepted, but yeah, you're right. It's totally watchable. That is the exact description for Accepted. Like, yeah, that was all right. That was 90 minutes. I'm good.
Yeah, that's there's some movies that's like, that's perfectly watchable.
Right.
I remember when I saw that in the movie theater, I was like, oh, I can't wait till this comes out on DVD with like the uncut R-rated version. And then it never, that, you know, apparently there was no uncut R-rated version of that movie.
It's my mission to comb through the Universal vaults and find all the weird Jonah Hill hardcore stuff that was cut out of Accepted.
But anyway, enough of that movie.
Anything else about Silver Bullet you want to mention?
I don't think so. It's just, it's a lovely movie. And, you know, there's a lot of little things, silly things, some more of the kinds of moments that we were already talked about. You know, even the fact that when we were talking about that scene that sets up Janie and Marty with the snake and she falls down, the fact that like she goes off to the, you know, to like a bush to kind of clean herself up. And then she witnesses this like fight between the woman that's about to kill herself and that, like, it's not my baby. Like, it sets up like this, the mood of this movie in a really like economical
way. Well, it's a super weird device to move the plot along. Cause she goes to the bush and I'm like, yeah, that makes sense. You know, she's upset. She's composing herself. She doesn't want people to see her cry. I get it. But then like, oh, and she overhears this weird fight that sets up the murder, that sets up the idea that he's killing sinners that goes nowhere.
So yeah, it really was just to let us know as a viewer of like why she's killing herself later.
Right. But then she even says like, pregnant women go to hell. No, she says suicides go to hell, especially when they're pregnant. Yeah. But yeah, I like this movie a lot. I think it's great.
And the other device that I love in all movies, which is perfectly exemplified in this movie, is that that woman has like a glossy 8x10 of the guy
to look at while she swallows her pills.
I always wonder, like, you know, who's that's like, you always see that in movies and like old TV shows, like this, like a headshot of like they just took the actor's headshot, put it in a frame. Like, that's
what is their relationship to where like she's so into this guy, she has a giant headshot of him blown up and framed on her dresser, and his investment is, I'm not the father. Like, what is that? What is the story between them?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you see that the scene where they have that little argument, I assume that he's having an affair with her.
Right.
She's like, don't talk to me here kind of thing. But yet she's...
But then she has that giant
She's
photo.
All in.
Oh, man.
That headshot tells us that she's all in.
well, whatever.
Yes, beautiful, beautiful film. I highly recommend it to anybody who hasn't seen it in a long time.
Yeah, hopefully we've turned some people onto it or convinced people who consider it the lesser of the King adaptations to maybe give it another shot. And again, it's never going to be for everyone, because like I said, you really have to buy into the sentimentality of it or the movie is not going to work for you. But if you think you might be able to, you should definitely revisit it. Let's plug all your stuff. Talk about, where can people find your book? Where can people find your podcast? Where can people find you?
Well, Scored to Death, Conversations with Some of Horror's Greatest Composers is available just about anywhere you can order a book. It's in some bookstores, but I can't tell you which ones. But
or
you can order
it at a bookstore.
You can order it on Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com and all that jazz. And on Twitter, I'm at Scored to Death. And there's a Scored to Death Facebook page also. I also have been going to horror conventions and selling and signing the book and also selling horror movie scores on vinyl.
Cool.
To kind of attract people to the table. So Twitter and Facebook are probably the best places to know if you're not in the Northeast, I'm not gonna see you at a convention. But if you happen to be in the Northeast, especially in the New York City area,
especially like right around where I live,
close to Philadelphia, I've done Monster Mania in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. I did the Chiller this year. So there's that stuff, and then of course Saturday night movie sleepovers. We have a pretty active Facebook page where people kind of chat with us, and we just have a good time over there. We also have Twitter, which is at Sat Sleepovers, and we're at Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers.com. But you can also hear the show on iTunes and Stitcher and all those crazy podcast distributors.
And be sure to subscribe to that show every week, and be sure to check it out this week to hear us talk about another 1985 werewolf movie. That's slightly different in tone, but we'll be talking Teen Wolf over at Saturday Night Movie Sleepovers. Thank you very much for coming on the show. This was super fun talking about this movie.
Yeah, I'm glad you had me back on. It was a good time.
Yes, anytime. Next week we'll be in the throes of Junesploitation, so expect some shows on some pretty fucked up stuff. But thank you guys very much for listening. As always, you can find us at fthismovie.net. We're on Twitter at fthismovie, on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, all that kind of stuff. Or you can always email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. And until next week, everyone, stay hairy.
Thanks for listening to FS Movie.